Okay, good afternoon. Thank you very much for staying so late. This is the last panel discussion, and basically the question was evolution of cancer, the new way of thinking. And I'm here with three eminent panelists, and we're going to give some background later on. Let me just start. You know, my name is Jean-Pierre Bizzari. I'm a medical oncologist. I've been 33 years in the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, I am what we call an exceptional survivor. I survived four mergers between Ron Poulenc-Rohrer, Sanofi, Sanofi Aventis. And I've been extremely fortunate in my life because I really came at the right time with Taxotere, with Irinotecan, with Oxaliplatin. And I joined Celgene 8 years ago, also at the right time, basically developing Revlimid and the last one, Abraxane. And now if you ask me what's probably the most interesting things I've done and I'm proud of, I would really say the pancreatic trial we've done with Abraxane. And, you know, I'm really sorry. I sound like a dinosaur and crocodile with because not a single time the word cytotoxic has been mentioned during this meeting. We're just talking about targeted therapy and you know, very specific things. But I'm very proud of the pancreatic study and what we've done with Abraxane Gem, because this has been gemcitabine has been a standard of care for 18 years, and I think we put Celgene, the company, put the money, the resources to do a study. And, you know, 2.1 month difference in overall survival is not a major increase. However, if you look at the one-year survival, you know, it's 8%, and the two-year survival is 5%. So basically, and that was really metastatic patients. So, you know, I'm very proud of that. So that being said, I would really like to congratulate, you know, the organizer of this meeting. I attended the 2 days. And I mean, I really love this kind of meetings where basically you have panelists, you can ask a question, you can see where we're going. And yesterday, I really learned a lot on immunotherapy, this morning on biomarker. And, you know, I really hope that we can translate that in our last meeting on evolution of cancer and new way of thinking. So I'm very, very pleased and honored to be chairman of this last meeting, and I'm not going to present the panelists, but I'm going to ask them to give basically a few words on background and the main interest. I think you all know them. They're very, very well known. They don't need any presentation. So we're going to start with Larry, if you can just give us.
It's probably not good to start with me. Can I? largely because my slides are better for follow up, but it's a small intimate audience, and I think we can do this. But can I show my slides, please? First slide, the second slide, third slide. Do we have a? Okay.
I think this one is your interest.
Yeah. Huh? Just Dr. Yeah. Norton, first slide.
Yeah, Larry, if you can tell us to, yeah. I mean, you know what everybody okay. knows what you have to.
All right, you see, my list of titles okay. is bigger Good. Than you know, it's bigger than I am.
Okay.
So they, so that this is, I'm deputy physician chief of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center for breast cancer programs, and I've run the breast cancer center as administratively. I've been president of ASCO. I've had a lot of titles. Very involved with the National Cancer Institute for many years. I'm essentially a medical oncologist, but as a medical oncologist, I've gotten very involved in the basic biology of breast cancer, in the whole translational milieu that we have at Memorial. You've already heard from Dave Solid and Neil Rosen, both of whom I work with very closely. So that kind of defines who I am. Do you want me to give my slides or just?
If you can wait just a minute, we'll come back to that.
Okay.
Kapil.
I'm Kapil Dhingra. I'm a medical oncologist by training. My faculty career was at MD Anderson mostly, in part along the way as a part-timer at Memorial Sloan Kettering. In the industry, 15 years or so, most of that was at Roche as head of global medical oncology clinical development. For the last 6 years, I've been an independent consultant. I've been on the board of directors of several successful biotechs such as Micromet, Algeta, et cetera, and currently on the boards of several companies, and I consult for a number of biotechs and VCs.
Bob?
So I'm Bob Beckman, and I have a twofold background. I'm an oncologist and also mathematical biologist. On the oncology side, I've been in industry clinical research for 18 years at Smith Kline Beecham, Centocor, AstraZeneca, Merck, and Daiichi Sankyo, and have developed a number of drugs by a number of different technology platforms. And on the mathematical biology side, I've had a variety of interests which have included the genetic instability of cancer and also studying cancer evolution. And recently I left industry to work on cancer evolution full-time and the implications of cancer evolution for treatment strategies. And so I'm now a professor of oncology and of, they call it BB&B, which is biostatistics, bioinformatics, and biomathematics at Georgetown.
Good. So, you know, when we got the title of a presentation, Evolution of Cancer, we discussed a little bit among us, and basically we came out with a conclusion that, in fact, there's two separate discussions. So the first one is evolution of cancer, where we're going, and I think the way we understand, and from a clinical standpoint, and how we can translate coming from preclinical to clinical. And the second is evolution of therapy. So we're going to start by evolution of cancer, and for me, you know, what's really the most surprising in my entire career is to really see that the heterogeneity of the cancer cells. I mean, I'm really amazed and astonished by the fact that there are so much heterogeneity, and I mean, when we discuss about single cell heterogeneity, that's really for me something extremely speaking. So I would like to ask, you know, the panelists, Larry, Kapil, and Bob, what they think about this evolution of cancer in terms of, you know, heterogeneity, and what they think about the relationship between what we have in preclinical and what we can do from a clinical standpoint. Larry?
Yeah, so now I can have my slides. Okay. I just want to make one theoretical point. That's not theoretical, actually. One new biological insight, and I think Kapil is going to follow up on this with things, because I think whatever we discuss moving forward, we have to have a framework. Can I have my first slide, please? That nice pretty picture you showed earlier, sir. We need a theoretical framework to hang it all on. I know that you had some great sessions about basket trials and targeted therapy and precision medicine and molecular targeting, and I do have comments about that, and I especially have comments about Abraxane, which I think is a fantastic drug. But I think we'll get to that in the question and answer period. One of the major discoveries in my mind in the last in the last few years is the fact that cell division is only one of the defects in cancer, and it may not even be the key defect. And this is work that that we've been doing at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and many other people have replicated it now. Theoretical paper 2006, proof of principle 2009, and now a great deal more work going forward. That the primary defect in cancer is cell mobility. Nobody ever died of cancer in its primary organ, if that primary organ can be treated with radiation or surgery or some locally ablative technique. It's metastasis. That's the lethal part of cancer. And what we discovered is that the metastasis is not just limited to go from the primary tumor in one direction to metastatic sites, but as you can see here, this is from the paper we published in 2009, that cancer cells can metastasize back to the site that they came from. And indeed, maybe 40% of the growth of a cancer is cells circulating and then coming back to where they came from. And this is true in metastatic sites, where cells can leave metastatic sites and go to other metastatic sites, or they can leave metastatic sites and go back to the same metastatic site. The big issue with this is you say, so what? You know, it leaves and comes back. What's the big deal? The big deal is that when it comes back, the act of coming back brings in blood vessels, and the act of coming back brings in white cells. And the white cells that come in the process turn out to be extremely important, not only for cancer growth, but extremely important for resistance to all the agents that we use, including targeted agents. There is a symbiosis between the cancer cell and those white cells. And next week you'll see a paper being published that will actually show that in half of the primary breast cancer that we've analyzed, the white cells infiltrating the cancer actually harbor leukemogenic mutations. The white cells coming in are not normal. The white cells are actually abnormal, and they are partially cancerous. They're not leukemia, but they're enough cancerous that combined with the epithelial component of the breast cancer, which is partially cancerous, that's what enables them to form a tumor. And this is a potentially an amazingly vulnerable site for drug intervention that has not actually been well exploited. And it solves a lot of mysteries that we can talk about in cancer that have been going on for a very long period of time. So the only point I want to make, and I'm only supposed to talk for 2 minutes, the only point that I want to make is that cancer is not just aberrant division of cancer cells. Nobody ever died of cancer cells. You died of tumors. Tumors are complex. They have blood vessels. They got white cells. They got stromal tissue, and they may have non-cellular elements. And the preparation for the spread of these cells may involve non-cellular elements, which I think Carfil is going to mention. And all of these add to complexity and heterogeneity, but they also give enormously attractive opportunities for drug intervention. And as so the evolution of cancer, evolution in general is not just a single organism. I mean, you know, you need two to tango, of course, to produce, offspring. But in addition to that, mobility is a very important factor in biosystems. And the same thing is totally true in cancer cells. And so it's not only contributing to the heterogeneity of the cancer, but also gives us enormous opportunities as the heterogeneity of drug therapy progresses for making significant advances. So those are my introductory comments. Thank you.
Kapil?
Thank you. So Jeff asked us to be provocative for this last session and talk about, he said, don't talk about things that everybody knows. Talk about something different. Push the boundaries. So I thought that's what I would do. And we'll do it in 2 minutes. So the good thing is everybody who believed in everything that has been talked about over the last 1¾ days is largely gone. So people who are left in this room are the ones who are going to drive the future of cancer research. So I'm going to put one postulation on the table. If I can have my slides, please. And what I want to postulate, because what we heard throughout this meeting is very much on the lines of Darwinian selection, that cancers are heterogeneous, they have mutations, and when you give a drug, cells that are resistant to those mutations get selected out or they evolve new mutations. That's exactly what Darwinian natural selection was. Survival of the fittest, and that's what Darwin postulated. And that's how I also grew up understanding how cancer evolves. But if you really step back and think about it, that sort of process is actually very inefficient. Try producing Herceptin resistance in a cell line in a xenograft in mouse and see how many months it takes, and then also you don't get a resistant cell line. Real life is different. You can take a cytotoxic drugs and try making resistant cell lines truly resistant. It's not as easy as one might think. And then to think that simply just because you can produce a mutation that will get selected out is probably not quite sufficient to explain, both in terms of the time frame in which cancers evolve. We know when you give a drug, literally within hours to days, cancer is starting to adapt. And that leads to this notion of that we need to postulate a different way that tumors actually evolve. This doesn't mean the natural selection type of situation doesn't exist. It does exist. But if that's all we focus on, or even if we primarily focus on that, we will miss a lot. And in fact, I would even go to the extent of postulating that that's perhaps why we have not made as much progress against cancer as we thought we should, because we're so focused on targeting this specific mutation. So let me lay out. There we go. Okay. So let's go back one slide. I think we went. Can we go back one slide?
This one, the red one is back.
Okay. There we go. So, and what I'll postulate is the notion of exosome. You know what exosomes are generally. All cells share lots and lots of vesicles. Cancer cells especially shared a lot of vesicles. And historically, these were thought of as garbage bags, that this is what the cell used to get rid of its garbage. However, over the last 10 years, if you look at it, exosomes are a real viable entity. They're shared by all cells, and it's remarkable what they contain. And I just put a listing here. Not all exosomes have all of them, but things that are relevant, microRNAs, messenger RNAs, amplified oncogenes, especially MYC, retrotransposons, line 1 sequences, ALU sequences, various metalloproteases, et cetera. And the reason why it's relevant is because you essentially have these FedEx packages, which have an address, that's the cell, the surface of the vesicle protein, and then inside there's a basket of contents which include certain RNA, certain proteins, so you can deliver a whole cargo, a self-contained cargo of things that the cell can use, a distant cell can use, without having to produce a single mutation or adapting its behavior in substantial ways. And this is the last slide I'm going to show. I won't go through all of this slide, but there's a large body of published literature that actually shows that exosomes, in fact, play a key role in preparing the metastatic niche. Before metastasis can be established, exosomes prepare the niche. They prepare, play a role in angiogenesis. They play a role in immuno-oncology, which is a buzzword of the day. And they can provide, if I can put it in a crude way, a sort of a Lamarckian evolution in real time, which is what I think we deal with our cancers when we give them our drugs or as they evolve naturally. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, Captain. Bob?
Okay, could I have my main deck of slides, please?
Main deck?
Yes. JP said I should have backups in case there wasn't a lot of discussion, but hopefully there will be a lot of discussion. So my... It's only three slides, and I'm actually going to focus on the genetic evolution, and I quite agree with Kapil and Larry that there's a lot more to the problem than genetic evolution, and there's a lot more than just the cancer cell itself. But I want to point out that I would just disagree with Kapil a little bit in the sense that I don't think we are taking even the genetic evolution of the cancer cell into account adequately in what we do. I think that the kind of adaptations that Kapil is talking about are likely occurring on a shorter time scale, and therefore a comprehensive model would include initial adjustments to therapy based on short-term Lamarckian adaptations, and then thoughts about the longer-term adaptations, which will be heritable and permanent and genetic. So I have three slides. And the first slide is a summary of what a longer talk would have in it. The first bullet is something that is largely agreed today, which is that tumors are genetically unstable, and this increases the clinical importance of evolutionary dynamics. And I just want to say, and you see it in the sub-bullets, that because I do mathematical modeling, people might say, well, who needs mathematical modeling? I will say that... in the early 2000s, some of this modeling predicted in a qualitative fashion most of the results that have come from the TCGA and the Sanger lab. And unfortunately, I made the mistake of putting it in the language of mathematics, and therefore it remained obscure. But I just want to point out that mathematics is powerful in physics and engineering. They've made quite a lot of progress. Now we've developed what we call non-standard personalized medicine strategies that in silico significantly improve predicted survival times and cure rates. And so by non-standard personalized medicine strategies, I'm also following Jeff Bachman's advice to stretch the boundaries here, because what I want to say is that personalized medicine, as we hear it in all the meetings, is... a tremendous advance over what we had before, but it's not enough. And so there are other ways to approach the problem. And in particular, current personalized medicine strategies, you get the average molecular properties of a tumor sample, you grind it up, you find it has a BRAF V600E mutation on average at a particular point in time, and then you plan the next one or two therapeutic maneuvers, which is exactly how I play chess, which is why anyone who's any good can beat me. Because people who learn to think ahead are more effective. So in this simulation that I'm going to describe to you, we adopted non-personalized medicine strategies. And a strategy is not a sequence of therapies. A strategy is a method for individualizing the sequence of therapies based on both static and dynamic information that you get from the patient. And having developed drugs in industry as a clinical researcher for 18 years, I just want to say that I'm going to present ideas which are not easily translatable today, except perhaps in the hematologic malignancies, because I need repeat sampling, and I need to be able to see subclones, and I need to understand the information, all of which is stuff that the field is working on, but we don't have it yet. And I do understand that. This is a, as the financial people say, this is forward-looking information. So the non-standard personalized medicine strategies consider explicitly subclonal structures that the tumor is not uniform, and explicitly consider evolutionary dynamics that the tumor is not static and will not stay the same, and even considers the risk of states that are currently undetectable or that might exist in the future and incorporates them into the strategy, and you try to optimize a whole multi-step plan the way a chess player would think multiple moves ahead. And in order to do this, it's not easy to translate today. But what would happen if you could do this? So the next slide, please. Oh, I'm sorry, I do the next slide.
The green.
This is a Kaplan-Meier curve from a simulation with 3 million virtual patients. And the 3 million virtual patients had different proliferation rates and different subclonal structures of their tumors and different genetic evolution rates. And these each patient represents a certain parameter set, and the parameter sets are based on a comprehensive survey of the literature to represent, be a survey across all possible reasonable parameter sets in oncology. 3 million virtual patients. In the blue line is what we see at all the meetings, and that's the survival from personalized cancer medicine, which is probably typical for metastatic tumors. And this is just playing a simple matching game, and it's hard to do. I won't say it's simple. I guess I shouldn't say it's simple, but you find the tumor type with molecular profiling, and you treat with a drug for that, and you just keep treating with that drug or drug combination until the patient stops doing well, and then you repeat the process. All of the other five curves for different strategies that take evolution into account give a far superior outcome that looks a little bit more like an immunotherapy curve. And, of course, the immune system has the ability to counter-evolve, which may be why it does so well. This is driven by about a third of the patients. But out of 3 million virtual patients, 3 million parameter combinations, there is not a single patient who did better on the current personalized medicine strategy. So there's no downside in applying this current personalized medicine strategy to everybody. The downside is that I don't know how to do it yet because I don't know how to get the information that the model needs every 45 days from a patient. But we're working on that. So next slide, please. Oh, I'm sorry. It's me again. I think it's
green.
Yeah, there we go. So I just want to give the high-level conclusions, and obviously we can have more details in the discussion. But I think the big message is that the current strategy that we use for personalized therapy of cancer, which was talked about in all the other sessions and at every meeting, is actually not the only possible strategy for dealing with the diversity and heterogeneity of cancer, and maybe is somewhat simplistic and naive in some regards. Genetic heterogeneity and evolutionary dynamics can greatly influence the optimal strategy for personalized medicine, and this is systematic study of these non-standard personalized medicine strategies, in other words, how to use the drugs that we have and how to use the genomic information that we have. It's not just so straightforward that you just can't have a separate field for studying that. And to be provocative, if we just keep inventing more drugs and getting larger genomic databases without figuring out sophisticated ways of integrating that into treatment strategies, I think our progress is going to be limited. And the benefits of this approach are potentially highly significant and very general across a large variety of tumor and therapy characteristics represented by 3 million virtual patients in the simulation. This does not deal with the additional complexities referred to by Kapil and Larry, which I completely agree with. And as soon as I figure out how to translate this, I would then turn my attention to the additional complexities that we all know are present. So,
thank you, Bob. So I think, you know, you heard the three panelists regarding, you know, this new way of thinking, and basically I would like to ask if there's any question in the room, you know, for the three panelists. Tom?
One of the concepts that I struggle with on this model is whether there is not a discontinuity in hypermutability that happens around genomic instability. When in the disease that occurs, what its significance is, and how one would model that in the context of emerging resistance to a given drug or to the natural sort of evolution of the tumor in a patient, you know, who does poorly compared to one who does quite well.
A discontinuity, and I didn't hear what the discontinuity...
Genomic instability.
Which is to say that all patients don't have the same, or that there's a change over time?
I think the question I would ask is whether there is not a change in either the rate of evolution of genomic instability or a, you know, discontinuous function around that as a major point that positions the tumor to be hypermutable, to evade and to adapt, and back to Kapil's, you know, sort of picture, to evolve much more rapidly.
So I think, first of all, one of the first things that we showed with the models back in the early 2000s was that if you want to evolve to become a tumor, you have to become genetically unstable pretty early on. So that most of these tumors already have some genetic instability, but then as part of that genetic instability, they're having mutations in all sorts of genes, including additional genes which are responsible for genetic stability. They have mutations in those genes, and therefore the genetic instability is constantly changing. And in the paper that we first published about this simulation in PNAS in 2012, we show a specific example where there are of one of the virtual patients that had a minority subclone that was only present at the level of one cell in 100,000, but was singly resistant. And you had two drugs in the model. You had two chances to kill the cell. The cell was singly resistant, and it was only one in 100,000 cells, but that cell had a different and higher mutation rate than the bulk tumor and was at great risk of acquiring, because of its enhanced genetic instability in that subclone, was at great risk of acquiring the second resistance mutation. And it turned out that that cell was the therapeutic priority, killing that minor subclone before it acquired the second resistance. So one of the things, not only can we not assume that the tumor has the same rate of evolution throughout its course, which I would definitely agree with, but we can't even assume at every point in time that all the cell subclones are evolving with equal speed.
Larry, you want to add something?
Yeah, I mean, great presentations and great question, and we could talk for hours, I think, over what's already on the table, but I just want to throw some things out sort of loosely related to this, that just for discussion. We're supposed to talk about new ways of thinking about cancer, and I must tell you is that my view of the emerging landscape of the mutational analysis, forgive me for doing this because I can't see faces because of the light, especially over there, so I should have worn my Yankees hat. Boston, I have to wear a Red Sox hat, but it's okay. I think most of the mutational changes that we're seeing are not oncogenic. They're allowing cells that are cancer cells to survive, but they're not the cause of the cancer. And that survival has a way of selecting out those genes, because most of the cells that are mutating are not surviving. It's my favorite story from Dwight Eisenhower's autobiography. You know, he saw somebody putting armor on parts of the plane where there were holes coming back from. He was in England during World War II in an air raid, and the technician said, "You know, this is pretty silly, General, because I should be putting armor on all the parts of the plane that don't have the bullet holes, because those are the planes that didn't come back." And the fact is that we're seeing, you know, the ones that came back had non-lethal injuries. And I think that that's got to be taken into account. I think there are two approaches, basically, to this that ought to be discussed. In terms of individualizing, really personalizing therapy, including personalizing scheduling, which we hardly ever do, could be a really key factor. I think the difference between cure and not cure is often not the drug sensitivity, but just by chance we hit the right schedule for that particular case. And, you know, we need ways of modeling it. The huge advances in imaging, particularly PET scanning with PET-specific reagents, I think is going to open up personalized scheduling and really transform the field. I just want to throw that out. But the two approaches is, one, we have a lot of drugs that work well. We can't forget that we have a lot of drugs that work well. The problem is that resistance emerges. and targeting resistance, as just happened with CDK4/6 inhibitors, for example, and with Afinitor, mTOR, and many other examples. That, I think, is a tremendously fertile field to look at, rather than trying to target what is the oncogenic mutation, when we often don't know what the oncogenic mutation is. All we see is the survival mutation, so that's one factor. The second is we are not properly targeting the phenotype. Now, whatever makes the criminal, whatever bad childhood they had that makes them a criminal, if you still catch them in the act of robbing somebody, the phenotype, you're going to be able to stop the crime. And there's all these potentials for phenotypic targeting with cancer, and I just sort of threw one out, which is cell mobility, which is just not targeted in general, but there's lots of ways of targeting it, and we're developing drugs and also devices, actually, Memorial Sloan Kettering, to take advantage of that. Cell-cell communications. Whatever's wrong with the cancer cell, it still has to communicate with other cells by exosomes or by other means to be able to survive. So I think that there are ways of actually getting around the rapid evolutionary change of these cells by various tools, and that's something that I think evolutionary science is leading us in the direction of.
Kapil, you want to add something?
No, I just going on a slightly tangential direction. I think one of the more interesting things is we used to think all these hypermutable cancers, genetically unstable cancers, are the toughest ones to treat because they can adapt quickly to the chemotherapies we give them. And suddenly the landscape has shifted with number of different classes of drugs that seem to target these tumors, whether it's a PARP inhibitors or whether it's PD-1, PD-L1 emerging data. What that does, it creates a real opportunity for us. Yes, they're great drugs for patients, but more importantly, they are tools to dissect out this biology to actually look at the impact of that hypermutable phenotype on the behavior of cancer and our treatments, because now we have both categories of drugs, the ones that work better for more genetically unstable tumors and the ones that work better for more genetically stable tumors. So I wanted to put that out there.
Thank you. Any other question from the room? Yes, please.
I just had a question to the slide that you mentioned with your model. If I understand correctly, you mentioned that if you could measure or assess the tumor every 45 days and adjust the strategy, you would increase the survival curve similar to immunotherapy. Is that what was shown in your plot?
Well, I was just commenting that if you look at the curves from those other strategies, it looks like an immunotherapy curve with 15 to 20% long-term survival. So in the simulation, we assume, which I know from my years of experience doing clinical research, that is going to be very hard, we assume that we can measure the subclones and that we understand how to define and identify them. The subclones are defined by sensitivity and resistance to the the model has two non-cross-resistant drugs or drug combinations. Four states, sensitive cells, sensitive to both. They're the two singly resistant states. And if you have the doubly resistant state in the model, then you're about to die. So in this setting, every 45 days, we ask how many of each subclone are present, and then we use the evolutionary model to do one of two things. Either the treatment is divided into 45-day blocks, and the next 45-day block can either be the 45-day what the model predicts will minimize the total number of cells, or the next block can be the treatment which is predicted to minimize the probability of a doubly resistant cell. And at every 45-day time point, you have to choose between those two priorities what you want, and the different strategies give you different criteria for choosing. But the premise is that you can, access the tumor, look at subclones, and understand what you're looking at. And all three of those are things, I'm currently looking for simple scenarios where you could actually instantiate this and get a proof of concept. I think that obviously hematologic malignancies offer the repeat access. Did that answer your question?
Yes, exactly. And so I think then it's very interesting to see that basically if you allow yourself to get smarter every 45 days, you can improve the treatment
Yes.
and the response to treatment. And I think that's something that it's gonna, I guess we're gonna look at that technology. There's sensor technology out there. There's all kind of ideas. How you almost could measure the changes in your tumor constantly. I think there's one aspect of that. I think technology, sensor technology is evolving very quickly, so that may be a thing of the future. The other thing that came to my mind is because that curve looks very similar to what was associated with immunotherapy, what it will do to lift the overall survival at the end. In a way, you could see the parallels between those mechanisms where the immune system actually recognizes what's going on in the tumor and then evolves the new strategy to develop T-cells and B-cells.
Yes, that's what I was thinking. The immune system kind of evolves, and I think one of the other challenges that I'd like to work on is this model is for targeted therapies. Traditional, they haven't been around for that long, but, you know, things like vemurafenib, whereas we don't have in the model things like delayed response, the ability to evolve, and all these properties of immunotherapies to make a mathematical model that would properly take that into account, which is simple enough to be computable and realistic enough to be meaningful, I think is an important challenge for us because we want to be able to answer questions like when should you give the immunotherapy compared to the vemurafenib, you know. So.
Thank you. Christoph.
I have a comment and a question. I think liquid biopsy where one detects DNA, you know, shedded DNA in the blood and sequences that is a very good measure that allows one to actually answer or address this question that you have. And some of the studies are published, and they show clearly that most mutations, if not all, are actually pre-existing before what we call acquired resistance, right? Therefore, yeah. Most of the mutations are there very, very early on, and mutations really are a fait accompli. They're something that has been there from the beginning. And that makes sense from the model we understand and from the dynamics that we know about sort of instability. That's the common. The question I have is, if there's this acquired instability or acquired that resistance that's pre-existing, how many drugs does one need to actually have a real impact on those unstable, heterogeneous tumors?
Yeah.
You don't know the numbers because you can't calculate it. What would be your guess?
Well, so let me start with the comment. First of all, I think there are three. Well, in addition to four tools, because there's imaging, there is the plasma DNA methods, circulating tumor cells, and exosomes may have information. I just want to point out that currently, what we do is at somewhat limited sequencing depth, and when you do. At sequencing depth where you can only see one in, let's say, 20 cells, when in fact in one of the virtual patients it was one in 100,000 cells that made the difference. What happens is you see the very early events because those events are going to be in all the cells. So for someone to use an experimental technique that is preferentially looking at early times, and then to say we use this technique and we prove that everything happens early, I think is actually a circular argument. And I think if you went to deeper sequencing, you would find that the tumor started out heterogeneous and kept getting worse. That's my opinion anyway.
I think it's more than opinion. I mean, that's the evidence. Clearly in breast cancer, we have a tremendous amount of evidence about the evolution of heterogeneity, and it's a continuous process. And every new metastasis is much more complex than the one before it. The reason why some of this is obscured is the fact is that the metastases are metastasizing to other metastases. So you're seeing a tremendous admixture of cells, not just the ones that arise in a given metastasis, but the ones that arise in other metastases that are spreading. But the continuous process of clonal evolution is a proven entity. And you don't have to sequence too deeply to see it. When you do very deep sequencing on a subset, you find, as I mentioned to you in the presentation, that there are also mutations in the stroma. And that's also got to be taken into account as you move forward. But don't... we can't forget, we have drugs that work. We have lots of drugs that work already. We can't forget this. We tend to talk about cancer as if right now it's an insolvable problem, and what are we going to do to solve the problem? We're solving the problem already for whole lots of people. And that success has to be taken into our thinking, as well as the potentials, the fact that we don't have total success, and why in a state of such rapid evolution of heterogeneity we are successful when we are successful. I think that is really one of the pressing questions.
So I just wanted to answer your question, though. So of course I don't know how many subclones there are, but let's just say from looking at the literature, which I think is a great underestimation because you'd find more if you sequenced more deeply. But, you know, people are finding at least 5 to 10, you know, subclones when they do these evolutionary trees in tumors. And I would suggest that many of those subclones may have different subsets of driver mutations, and therefore they have different pathways active. And based on feedback loops within pathways and all that data, someone was talking about Chandra Lapati's data from Memorial Sloan Kettering recently. You're going to need, just to hit one pathway, you're going to need a combination of several drugs. And I would suggest that you might have, 10 or 12 different pathways active if you encounter all the subclones. So one of the things that I want to say, which is also a little bit subversive, is that if you have 10 or 12 subclones and you need 2 or 3 drugs in a combination synergistically to hit a single subclone with its set of active pathways, and you need to give about 30 drugs, simultaneous combinations are not the answer, because you won't be able to give those 30 drugs all at once at meaningful doses. But what you may be able to do is to intersperse very brief periods of high-dose monotherapy with other periods of combinations and so on. So when you do this computational modeling, every 45 days you're changing therapies, and you could have a pulse of high-dose drug A, and the next pulse is triple combination ABC, and the next pulse is double combination BC. And over time, you're giving all 3 drugs, but you may not be giving them all as simultaneous combinations. And I think that's an important point. I think it's not quite so simple as let's just give everything all at once.
Okay, I think, I would like just to continue a little bit, and you can discuss that, unless you have a burning question.
Yeah, I just want to give it an okay. Optimistic sort of twist. I actually think one needs about 4 drugs.
Okay.
And even that 4 vulnerabilities, and I think that will be enough. And it reminds me of the HIV discussion, where we originally thought, like, this is impossible. Yeah. And it ended up being 3 drugs. And I think when one evolutionary sort of plays it through and does the models, I am much more optimistic. I think 4 will do it.
Okay.
Kapil? Yeah, I think it's a philosophical debate we're picking up. So, JP, with your indulgence, let me just take a minute. I think actually how many drugs one needs is probably going to end up missing the point, because I understand the goal is to cure cancer and we want to figure out how many drugs we need. But I think you yourself said this morning, each patient's cancer is unique. It's evolved, it's heterogeneous, and I could almost argue not only each patient's cancer is unique, it's actually multiple unique diseases that evolve every day practically. So if I think like it's a moving jigsaw puzzle that's constantly changing shape, and if that's how I conceptualize it, then we'll be paralyzed. So then I come from the other side. Why is it that we have cured as many people with adjuvant chemotherapy of breast cancer as we have? But in a large number of them, if you look with sensitive enough techniques, you will find tumor cells are still sitting in the bone marrow. And those are the ones come back 20 years later. So I think, yes, eventual goal is cure of cancer. But in the meantime, we can think more about restoring homeostasis, if you will, whether it needs 2 drugs or 3 drugs at any given point in that patient's unique diseases, with perhaps a bit of microenvironment, immunotherapy, sort of keeping things in check, to a degree keeping new clones from emerging. That's not a bad intermediate practical way to think about it.
Well, I think that despite JP's perhaps tongue-in-cheek apology about Abraxane, one of the reasons why chemotherapy won't go away is that it is broadly attacking a lot of different types of cells. And, we had a call before this panel to talk about it, and Larry used a metaphor which I'd like to borrow, if that's okay, Larry. And you said, cancer is like a herd of elephants coming at you. And I think we talked about whether if you had a herd of elephants coming at you, whether you would hire a sharpshooter to aim very precisely at one of those elephants or whether you take a different strategy. So I think it's good to have the sharpshooters as part of your armamentarium, which would be the targeted agents. But if I had a herd of elephants running at me, I might try something more like Abraxane, you know, because try to get as many elephants as possible, you know, before they got me.
Good. I think you know, I would like to move to the second part of a discussion. You have only 29 minutes to go. But the second question really I was interested was really the evolution of therapy. And I just would like to give you the privilege of dinosaur of, you know, oncology to, you know, to have this kind of view. But the way I look at the therapy, and once again, it's only my opinion, is that, you know, when I started oncology in 78, when I graduated, and basically from 78 to 2000, the only things we had was really cytotoxic. And, I mean, for us, in clinical setting, the most important was platinum first, because we really saw responses in lung, in head and neck, and in other indication. And then, you know, you add all the other drugs, Taxotere in 90, irinotecan, CPT-11 in 92, oxaliplatin in 96, etc., etc. So that was really the first phase from 78 to 2000. I think in 2000 we saw something which for me was really great. It was the Herceptin. And, I mean, congratulations to my friend Kapil, who did the development, because, I mean, it was a targeted therapy with a huge response and huge hazard ratio. I mean, we never been to a hazard ratio of 0.6. I mean, we used to have a hazard ratio of 0.8, 0.85, but with Herceptin, we had a really an outstanding hazard ratio. So this is point number two. I think for me also what was really incredible, it was in 2010, and what I was really, really happy with was the results of Dendreon, because it was, for me at least, the first demonstration that a vaccine could have an impact, and the impact was huge. It was a difference of 1 year in terms of survival. So for me, it was the first demonstration that a vaccine can work. And the last things, of course, is 2014 with immunotherapy and PD-1 and you know, one thing I was extremely, extremely impressed is that I did the review for Celgene of the Carrion data on the CAR-T in Philadelphia, and I reviewed the patient profile, and I was really, you know, stunned by the activity and the patient profile. So I can really, you know, be a witness of the kind of activity we get. So the question I would like to ask to the panelists is basically, how do you see the future of therapy? Do you think that immunotherapy is going to be the key? Do you think that, where do you think we're going? And I'm going to start, Larry.
Oh, my goodness gracious. I just want to mention this, you know, because I've spent a lifetime not mentioning it, is, you know, I'm the author of the Norton-Simon model, which is the first mathematical model that actually had an impact on cancer therapy. And so, you know, I've been involved in this thing for a long time. I just want to mention that because I know that you're all younger than I am in this audience, and so you don't may not know that. And Kapil and I were both involved with the development of Herceptin. Indeed, it was the combination with Taxol that made the difference, which developed with John Mendelsohn, Jose Pasalga, and myself at Memorial. So I've been watching the whole evolution of this thing, you know, very intimately all during the, you know, all during this period. So, I mean, I think I have a little bit of a historical overview in this regard. My favorite quote in this regard is from Mark Twain, who says, "It's not what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that turns out to be wrong." And so I am always very, very concerned when I hear people say, "Well, we know the answer to cancer is." Because I've been hearing this a lot over this period. I remember when the answer to cancer was chemotherapy. I remember when the answer to cancer was combination chemotherapy. I remember when the answer to cancer was antivirals. I remember when it was high-dose chemotherapy, the autologous bone marrow rescue. And now I'm here, and everybody knows the answer to cancer is immunotherapy. If that is true, if it's historical fact, you probably should place a bet that it's not. All right, because so far, as soon as everybody knows something is true, it seems not to be the case. But I think there's enormous promise there. I think the one thing I want to emphasize, which is so obvious, and we never emphasize it, is Herceptin as a single agent is awful. It's about a 20% response rate, and it lasts for a few weeks as a single agent in responsive disease with high levels of HER2. You have to combine it with chemotherapy. There's been a few examples where immunotherapy have in lung cancer approval just as recently where immunotherapy has an impact. But the real impact of melanoma is with chemotherapy. And there's a lesson in there which we have to pay attention to. Herceptin is an augmenter of cytotoxic chemotherapy. That's what Herceptin does. As a single, there's a good target. It's a very robust target. There's a very effective drug. You can get good blood levels that are actually biologically active. And yet, it doesn't do anything unless you combine it with cytotoxic therapy. What does that mean? And to some extent, I think one of the possibilities of what it means is that it is immunotherapy. Is that maybe everything we do is immunotherapy. Is if we can change the balance of the cancer cells and the host in the right way at the right time, where immune mechanisms can sort of kick in, that's where we are really getting the impact. And so the important thing that I think moving off in the future is not to assume that we know more than we do, but to ask really good questions and to look carefully at what we see to derive the answers from that. And, the relationship with the cancer cells to the stroma is essentially we don't have any drugs that we know that do that, and that might be totally key to the operation. No matter how many cancer cells you got flowing around your blood, if they can't form tumors, you're not gonna get sick. Even in leukemias, what you really die of is marrow aplasia, and you die of marrow aplasia because the tumor, the leukemia, has occupied all the space in the bone marrow. So innovative thinking really has to be supported in this regard, and really across the board, in industry and academia, and in government sponsored activities. So that's really where I think the real progress is going to be made, is by looking at successes and trying to figure out why. The answers may be just staring us in the face. And this is always true in the history of science. If you look at the history of science, always, whenever a major discovery is made, everybody says, gee, we could have made that 30 years ago. It was pretty obvious, even 30 years ago. Matter of fact, there's a paper buried in some obscure journal that actually made that point. It's always true, all throughout the history of science. We probably already know the answer. It's probably staring us in the face, and we're not identifying it yet.
Thank you, Rami. Kepia?
I totally agree with Larry. I think the lessons of history are forgotten over and over again. I can't tell you how many advisory boards from biotechs I've been in last 6 months where so many people, especially from academia, saying, well, you see, immunotherapy is great because there cannot be any resistance to it because immune cells don't mutate. So there's no resistance to it. And you just have to remind that it's only 12 years before that they said same thing about anti-angiogenic drugs, that, see, anti-angiogenic drugs, there cannot be any resistance because cancer cannot go beyond 2 millimeters without blood vessels and endothelial cells are normal. So, yes, immunotherapy will be an important modality of therapy. I just ask you to look at the tail of those survival curves, and when the overall survival curve tail gets up top, then I'll believe immunotherapy is the final answer.
Thank you. Bob, you want to add something?
I think other than agreement with those two things, that and the only thing else I would already say is that I'm particularly interested in the capacity of the immune system to evolve and how that you could represent that mathematically in a useful way. I agree. I tend to be skeptical of any panaceas.
Is there any question regarding this evolution of therapy in the room? Good. So I would like... Oh, please. Jeff, you have a question, Jeff?
So this be for Larry initially. So what are the studies, your studies or others, showing right now in terms of these mutations in what would have previously been considered, kind of the normal cells, whether it's the stroma, whether it's macrophages, et cetera, in terms of when they're occurring, and more importantly, kind of how they're occurring, how this co-opting is occurring? And is it in fact a presumption that the co-opting is occurring after the fact from the tumor as opposed to some other?
The field is too young. I mean, I think that we have a lot of things that we're studying in this regard, so the field is too young to basically answer those questions. But I can tell you, what we're looking at. The fact is that You know, it's like the Zen koan, the sound of one hand clapping. You know, you can have an abnormality in epithelial cell, no sound, an abnormality in a white cell, no sound. If they happen to come in proximity, that's when you get a tumor. And I think that is where it's looking like it's evolving. One of the major reasons that we thought of this, there were two. I'll tell you all the whole stories. One of them is it's been bugging us for a long time that all the mutations we see in invasive breast cancer are found in ductal carcinoma in situ. And if you just actually look at molecular profiling, you can't tell the difference between DCIS and invasive cancer, even in the same patient. So that is immediately telling you there's something weird going on here, and maybe it's something else happening beside the actual changes in the cancer cell. That's the first. Second is a patient that I had when I was a very young man in Mount Sinai Hospital. I remember I had a full head of hair at the time. That's how long ago it was. And the, you know, it's true. I can show you pictures. And that the where a patient presented with acute leukemia and metastatic breast cancer at the same time, and of course the life-threatening problem was the acute leukemia, so we treated that, and her metastatic disease disappeared. It was biopsy-proven disease. I don't have a long enough follow-up to know how long it was disappeared, but I do know that she actually had a remarkable complete remission of her metastatic disease, and that's always haunted me in the back of my mind, and has always sat there as well. We haven't really screened anti-leukemic therapies, but these, for the most part, what we're seeing is that these are solitary mutations that we're seeing. My guess is what's happening, and we already know for a fact, like TET2 mutations, which is a leukemogenic mutation, occurs in all people as we get older. Everybody's bone marrow, especially over 50 and especially over 60, will have, if you sequence deeply enough, some mutant white cells. They don't have leukemia, but you have the mutations in the individual cells. And we know that a lot of epithelial cancers, except and even in the presence of a carcinogen like cigarette smoke, which accelerates it, you know, occur in older people. And it may be that it's just the coincidence of having spontaneous mutations in bone marrow and spontaneous mutations in the epithelial cells. We've also got a really nice study that's cooking, and I could have had the answer already, but it's cooking in secondary leukemias in patients with solid tumors. You know, we see some when with secondary, and if you don't know this, is you treat people with chemotherapy for breast cancer and many other diseases, and they get really good response, but then they get leukemia, and it happens with adjuvant chemotherapy really as well. But some of those leukemias that emerge very, very rapidly after the chemotherapy sometimes, and really much more rapidly than one would expect. And we're actually looking at those cases now to see if maybe those leukemias were pre-existing in those individuals and contributed to their solid tumors. And then we're obviously also doing functional studies. What's being secreted by the white cells? We're doing conditional mutations. We're looking beyond the usual things toward microRNAs and also non-coding regions of RNA in that regard. So we've actually started a pretty big program to try to exploit this. It very well might be that the reason why we get good responses when we get good responses is because we're hitting something other than the cancer cell. And that is something that, again, when we look at the exceptional responders, and some of the exceptional responders, Dave Sollett was here earlier, he might have talked about the work that he did in that regard, we do find a very good mechanism. And in most of them that we're studying, we're not finding a very good mechanism, and it might be because we're looking at the wrong cell population.
Okay,
that's good, thank you.
Comment, Bob, you okay? Please,
so in theory, then, it's possible that aside from the debating whether the immune system could be the panacea and the counter-evolutionary force, it is also conceivable then it may be the original prime mover, bad actor, and that it doesn't start in endothelial cell or someone else, that somehow it starts as a dysregulation in a white cell.
Well, I've got to remember that in human diseases, more human diseases are caused by an overactive immune system than an underactive immune system. You know, people with pan immunodeficiency are pretty unusual, but there's a lot of psoriasis in the world, and, you know, there's a lot of, you know, rheumatological diseases in the world. And even coronary artery disease is related to inflammation. We see inflammation associated with all solid tumors, prostate, very good example, as well as breast cancer. So it very well might be that the wonders of the immune system might, you know, I mean, the immune system evolved to fight bacterial infections, you know, and that's what it's good for. That's its purpose. There may be a dark side of that process.
You have a question? Yeah.
Yes, thank you, Spiro Robotis from Cyclocell. Thank you for a very provocative expose of evolution. Could you be so kind to share your thoughts on the effect of cross-treatment with agents in the same pathway to the evolution of resistance? One very provocative recent experience is we're treating people with high-risk MDS with azacitidine who were then cross-treated with decitabine. And our collaborators at MD Anderson said that they could not kill those clones after biopsy with anything available. Clearly, these were susceptible cells that after cross-treatment became highly resistant. Is that something we could model? And how could we possibly get an understanding how a pharmacologic intervention changes the evolutional dynamics you explained in the context of how to choose appropriate therapy?
Harry, I think that's for you.
That's Bob. That's hard. That's math. That's
oh, yeah. Well, as Larry pointed out, I'm just following his footsteps. But in any case, what I would say about that is you're talking about evolution in response to therapy, I think, was the question. And so I have a unusual view about that. Many of the people who do mathematical modeling in the field would say that the cancer cells, the different types of cancer cells, and they're competing for a finite niche. And when you eliminate one subpopulation, perhaps the major subpopulation, some of these other subpopulations come up. And I would actually, my thought is that they're not competing for a constant niche. The niche is constantly expanding. That's called metastasis. If it was a constant niche, we wouldn't have a clinical problem, as others have pointed out. And so I actually think that when you treat some of those subclones were there already, but because when you measure, you're measuring an average property, you can't see those subclones until you eliminate the other cells. And then those subclones which were there before keep growing independently and become the dominant population in a mixture, which is not to say I don't think that they compete sometimes, but I think they also cooperate sometimes. That's been documented. And they compete sometimes, and I think sometimes they're independent. Therefore, so far in my model, starting out with something very simple, I have assumed that they're all independent. And you still see in the simulations that you have a cell that was a minority cell before, and it's growing independently, but so is the other larger population. Then when you eliminate the larger population, if you were to look at a mixture, the mixture now is dominated by the smaller cell, not necessarily because of some competitive dynamic that was interfered with. Sometimes, maybe, but I'm not convinced that that's proven in all cases. Okay.
I just want to make one quick comment about resistance, and I'm supporting what Bob is saying here in this regard, is that most of the resistance that's induced, and this work of Siraj Chandrapati and Neil Rosen and that you already heard about, is unstable. The best way to get really bad resistance in any system is to treat continuously at a sublethal dose, which is what we generally do, especially with these targeted therapies. And if you can have a break in therapy, such as by alternating different treatments, 45 days or whatever is the right interval for that individual patient, you might be able to downregulate the resistance mechanisms. So really personalized scheduling, taking that into account, could really have a very, very significant impact. My modeling has suggested that, and I think Bob's has also suggested that you can have a very big impact by doing that. And so we can't forget the instability of a lot of the resistance mechanisms.
So if there is no more question, I would like to ask the last question, which is for me quite important, which is basically the challenge. And I'm just going to give you my opinion. I would like really to get the opinion from the panelists on what will be the challenge, I would say, in the next 5 years. So I see two challenges. The first one is the bioinformatics. I really think that this is key. You know, I belong to the French National Cancer Institute. Basically, 8 years ago, we tried to do a little bit what the NCI, with the money we had in France, which is $300 million a year. And we had a panel and things like that. And one of the things we discussed, basically, is the need to recruit people who are between the clinical people, between the preclinical people, and are able to do this kind of link. I mean, I am convinced that 99% of the information we get is background noise, and that we're not able, because, you know, we don't have the tool, we don't have the people who really know how to do the things, we are not able to do the link between the what we find in preclinical, the tissue, the genomic and everything, and the clinical outcome. And this is just a question of background. So this is my first point. My second point, I really, really believe, and I can give you an example, that one of the key elements is to go very early in the diagnosis. I mean, I'm so, for me, it's such a pity that you didn't have a meeting on that. And, you know, yeah, but I think it's extremely important because if you look, for example, what is specific indication, you know, I know quite well, which is myeloma, because Celgene is really a leader in the myeloma indication. I mean, we really moved the survival from 8 months to 8 years in the last, I would say, 20 years. But what do we have to do now? I mean, if you want to do a trial in myeloma, you cannot because the survival is too long and basically we'll be confounded by everything you're doing with at least 5 or 6 lines of therapy. And I think the solution for me is to go very, very early with what we call the MRD, minimal residual disease, and discuss, you know, with this kind of tool who can really identify the patient, MRD positive, who is going to relapse or who is going to present kind of thing. So I think this is true in myeloma, it's true in CLL. So I really think that this is, for me, one of the key challenge. And if we're not addressing that now, you know, we will be almost blocked from a clinical development standpoint. And I would like to ask the, you know, the panelists what they think about, Larry.
Well, I mean, tough question. All of the above. All right. But in addition to all of the above, I'll say something really outrageous. I think we need a new business model. Is where we are in cancer medicine compared to where we were 25 years ago and where we are in portable computing compared to where we are 25 years ago is pretty shocking. And I think that the major difference is the business model worked here and the business model is not working for cancer drug development. That's my view. And the reason I'm saying that is because I see so many in my position of Memorial Sloan Kettering and, you know, kind of being a senior person in the field, I see so many phenomenal ideas. Totally different ideas, brilliant thought, all right, in laboratories that just die in the laboratory for lack of early funding, for bad IP, which is probably the number one reason. You know, the guy got really excited, so he sent an abstract in and it's gone. You know, if I cured cancer tomorrow and I got so excited I sent an abstract in on it, you know, the day after tomorrow, it could never be developed. And never, no matter how good the idea is, I've ruined it now. This happens over and over and over again, and I think we need a reinvention of the business model for very early development of devices, of diagnostics, of imaging tools, of therapeutics, so it can get to the level that the cell genes of the world can actually put, you know, invest in it and really develop it further. I think in that regard, I think the quickest path to significant improvement is overcoming mechanisms of resistance to existing agents. That's the quickest path. Long term, there's a whole lot of good ideas. We mentioned them all. I'm not going to belabor them in this regard. But we need to turn cancer therapeutic diagnostic development into this. And that's going to take the invention of the business community in really novel and innovative ways. That's what I'd like to see. People are always asking, you know, where's the answer to cancer going to be? Is it going to be this, that, or the other thing, prevention, you know, immunotherapy? I say, I'll give you the answer if you tell me what's the most important part of the airplane. Is it the left wing? Is it the right wing? You know, what about the landing apparatus? You know, and then they kind of fluster and say, well, it's the whole airplane. I say, no, there's an answer. The most important part of the airplane is the wind tunnel. Because that's where you test it before you actually put people in something and send them up into the air. And we don't have the right wind tunnel for cancer therapeutics.
Kapil?
So I was just going to address the other part of your question, which is drug development. I'm actually not overly concerned or pessimistic in terms of challenges of drug development. Because, yes, myeloma survival is 8 years, but that in some ways, while in some ways makes life difficult, in other ways actually makes life easier. And I think we have to learn the lessons from our colleagues outside of oncology, where people live forever. And when you're going to live for 8 or 10 years, it actually gives you lots of windows of opportunities to intervene with new drugs. So I view the challenge more as long as we're coming up with good drugs, you can test it very late line therapy, and we know these drugs have worked in people on their deathbed, quote unquote. And you can use window of opportunity trial, you can do minimal residual disease trial, and with all the mechanisms evolving to really take them to frontline setting, when you merge that with sort of next-gen imaging, functional imaging, et cetera, I think our life should be great, actually, in the next 10 to 15 years.
Good. Bob?
Well, I guess I agree with everything that's been said once again, and I guess the one thing that I would add is that, you know, in this panel, we've been encouraged to think outside the box and be a little bit provocative. And I think what we see in the funding landscape is that there are occasional grants for people thinking outside the box. Those relatively rare grants are highly competitive, and you better have lots of preliminary data and be an established investigator that everyone knows who you are. So I wonder if we can develop a funding system that actually would accept the kind of entrepreneurs who built Google and other computer companies in their garages. Because I think in our funding system, someone would say, well, so-and-so is working out of his garage. Why doesn't he have an appointment at Memorial Sloan Kettering? So
he's better off in the garage, I think.
Yeah. anyway.
Okay, so I think, you know, we're on time. So I just want to thank you, Larry, thank Kapil, to thank Bob for presentation, and thank you for staying solid.
Thank you.